From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's show, 150 Chinese officials and business people visited Michigan this week looking to make deals.
China is an enormous export market for a lot of Michigan companies.
We talked to a Michigan State University trustee about culture change.
We need to change our posture of being so defensive and really begin to implement real reform.
We asked if reform started with the Board of Trustees, an idea that allows neighbors to invest in their neighborhood.
But unfortunately, a lot of people feel that if they're not a billionaire, celebrity, politician, there's no way for them to invest into trace recovery.
And making art in an abandoned space.
I'm interested in how people perceive a ruin within a ruin. Why one ruin might be considered a monument, while another might be considered something negative.
Plus, we've got a cocktail for you. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we'll hear from an MSU trustee who says he has a plan for how to change the culture of Michigan State. But first, let's check in with our Friday commentators, Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, a senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. Well, for the first time, all four of the Republicans running for governor debated this week. Bill Schuette finally joined Brian Kelly, Patrick Kolbeck, and Jim Hines for a televised debate. What did we learn about the candidates, Vicki?
I think that we learned that tax cuts for tax cuts' sake is still the mantra. I didn't hear an awful lot of substance. There were a lot of discussions on the environment with platitudes again. I think the thing that struck me the most, however, was the sparring that still continues between Bill Schuette and Brian Kelly. And Lieutenant Governor Kelly is working very hard to try to dispel the notion that he is not a Trump supporter. And Attorney General Schuette is saying every other sentence is that he's supported by President Trump. So I found that very interesting.
How about you, Ken?
You know, Lester, I'm not a fan of early debates. I think this debate in particular is just too early in the primary season to make much difference. The August primary already has a problem with low voter turnout, and but the voters who do pay attention in August don't start doing that till late July. So I just don't think this debate is going to make a lot of difference. I just kind of don't like the dynamics of debates much anymore. The moderator, in this case, Rick Allman, and generally speaking, the moderators try to steer the candidates into substantive discussion on substantive issues. But the candidates and their consultants, you know, have different ideas and different strategies. And so I'm somewhat disenchanted. I don't think the voters really get to learn much. And like I said, I just think it's too early.
I think there's another problem with only a one-minute answer. It's very difficult to talk about policy in 1 minute.
Especially when you're talking about four candidates.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, and Vicki's absolutely right. You know, Bridge Magazine this morning, to their credit, pointed out that in the course of the debate, there was discussion about education and the economy and the environment. But they also pointed out, as Vicki said, it's hard to have a real substantive discussion when you have a limited time. And the media, generally speaking, with the exception, of course, of Michigan Radio,
thanks for that.
And Bridge Magazine. But, you know, their focus after the debate is sort of, you know, what fireworks occurred.
Right.
So they don't even report on the discussion, as limited as it might be, on these more substantive issues. So that's the other reason I'm kind of disenchanted. The much of the media focuses on sort of fireworks, and I don't see how that's particularly helpful either.
Well, here I go doing exactly that. The Republicans and the three Democrats, Gretchen Whitmer, Abdul El-Sayed, and Sri Tanadar, were all on stage for a forum in East Lansing. Senator Patrick Kolbeck brought up his unsubstantiated claims that El-Sayed has ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. El-Sayed blasted Kolbeck as being a bigot and looked to the other Republicans to speak up against bigotry. And the three other Republicans had nothing to say about Kolbeck's comments other than Sharia law has no place in Michigan. What did you make of that?
I, I'm shocked that there's no calling out of bigotry. It was a shameful statement. It's been a continuing problem. And while Senator Kolbeck insists that he has no problem with Muslims, he insists on making ties to Abdul el-Sayed, to the Muslim Brotherhood, that are totally unsubstantiated. And it's a real problem. And without anybody calling him out, he's going to continue to talk this way and build his base this way. And I think there's really no place in Michigan for this kind of bigotry.
Ken, what did you think about the other Republicans not really wanting to make a comment about it?
I think they should speak out. I don't understand Senator Kolbeck's kind of persistence in this this sort of line of, or this theme. The only thing I can think of is, in the words of Forrest Gump, stupid is as stupid does. You know, it was stupid when he first did it, and it's just stupider that he keeps talking about it. Talk about roads and education and water, environment, and if he wants to, talk about tax cuts. That's what people care about.
Speaking of Abdul el-Sayed, the Secretary of State's office has indicated, even though the candidate voted in another state, he continued to be a registered voter in Michigan the entire time. Therefore, he's eligible to be a candidate for governor. Is that whole issue now settled, Vicki?
I think it is, and I'm glad to see that it's settled well before the primary election. I think it was time that we got that settled and out of the way so that the candidates can continue to carry on their campaigns.
Ken, the one thing that's still up in the air, though, el-Sayed went to court asking a judge to rule on his eligibility. That's still before the Court of Claims. Are we getting ahead of ourselves here?
Well, we talked about this before. I think the courts are going to be very reluctant to weigh in on this. I think this gentleman's going to be on the ballot, as he apparently should be, and I don't think the courts are going to sort of weigh in any way, shape, or form, particularly in terms of trying to take him off the ballot.
Okay, so what I'm taking from this conversation is we don't need any more debates until about late July, and we should look for el-Sayed to actually be on the ballot. That's what I'm taking away from it.
That's part of the takeaway. The other is that although people love to, you know, try to arrange debates, there's got to be some structure, and I agree with Ken, where there can be substantive conversation about the goals of each candidate in what they hope to accomplish, instead of the platitudes, the attacks, and all of the other things that take up these one-minute answers that we currently see on television.
Ken, last thoughts?
Well, if you're behind, you attack. And if you're ahead, you try to avoid a blunder. And I think you sort of saw that in the debate with Kelly and Schutte. But I just don't think they're that informative for the voters.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican state legislator. Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic state legislator. Thanks for talking with me and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings, and we're in Detroit at Wright & Company, and we're here with Mark Cooney. Thanks for making a drink for us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Happy to have you guys.
We always like Michigan ingredients. Tammy, you know more about these two liquors than I do. What do we have here?
Well, we have a couple spirits from Two James, neither of which we've used in cocktails before, so that's pretty exciting. There's their Nain Rouge Absinthe and then a barrel-aged gin, the old Cockney gin. And when I saw these ingredients going up on the counter, I asked Mark, are you making a Corpse Reviver number two? Because that is one of my all-time favorite drinks.
Why'd you choose this drink?
So the Corpse Reviver 2, it was one of the first cocktails that I have ever had in terms of like that kind of craft. So for me, it has a lot of sentimental, you know, value to it, where this is truly, in my opinion, one of the drinks that wanted me to get into doing this. That, you know, the restorative properties, it's technically a hangover drink, so we've all been there and done that, so these definitely got me through some hard times. But, you know, it's just that kind of nostalgic. Every time I have one, I see one being made and I smell it. It reminds me of why I love what I'm doing and why I got into the whole thing.
So one of the things I love about this cocktail is that it's just equal parts, so it's really easy to make. I always say equal parts drinks are the best because if you're on a beach and all you have is a clamshell, you can still make a really fine cocktail. So Mark, why don't you tell us specifically what ingredients you used?
So what I used in this particular cocktail was 3/4 ounces of fresh lemon juice, 3/4 ounces of dry curacao, orange dry curacao, 3/4 ounces of Cokie Americano white wine aperitif, 3/4 ounces of 2 James Barrel Aged Gin, put into a tin, shaken, and then just a rinse of the absinthe on the inside of a coupe. Then pour the drink inside of that coupe. And the reason that we're using the rinse for that is absinthe in itself can be very, very overbearing and overpowering. What I want to do is make sure that flavor is kind of like the afterthought, just like that little, you know, a little wisp, a whisper, if you will. And then the nose is what's important. So you're getting all those wonderful star anise qualities, all those wonderful wormwood that really do go very well with the lemon and, in this particular instance, the barrel aged gin.
All right, Tammy, you know this drink better than I. I'll have you taste it and tell me if Mark did any good or not.
All right, I'm going in. Well, it does have a great aroma from that absinthe, which is one of the things that I love about this drink, is that it immediately brings something to you before you've even tasted it. So I've not had this with a barrel-aged gin before, and I just really like what that brings to the drink. It works really nicely with the other ingredients and kind of makes a little bit of a mellower interpretation than some of the more sharp gins that I've tended to use in the past. So this is a really nice example.
All right. Well, I'm not an expert on Corpse Survivor 2 like you are, but I've had a couple before. Oh, well. Even better than I remembered. It's been a while since I've had one. I don't know why now. So why Corpse Survivor number 2?
Well, as Mark said, these were intended as hangover cures, and the Corpse Survivors were a category of morning drinks. We only have recipes for the number 1 and the number 2, but we know there were at least 6 in the numbered sequence. Number 1 is horrible. Number 2 is one of the all-time great drinks.
That's the Corpse Survivor number 2 at Wright & Company by Mark Cooney. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Coming up, a Detroit-based artist who uses found materials to create massive installations in abandoned spaces.
I'm interested in how people perceive a ruin within a ruin, why one ruin might be considered a monument, while another might be considered something negative.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, maybe nobody mentioned it to you, but this has been Michigan China Week. Chinese officials and business people from 6 provinces have been visiting Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Grand Rapids. Here to talk a bit about the visit and trade with China is Brian Connors. He's the executive director of the Michigan China Innovation Center. Before we get to this week's visit, let's go over what's happened in the last year and a half. Chinese President Xi Jinping has been sounding much more nationalist. American President Donald Trump has been talking about tariffs on several Chinese imports. How close are we to an all-out trade war?
Well, it's a great question. And ultimately, I think only the U.S. trade rep and his team who are leading the discussions can really testify to the latest of that. But certainly tensions are at an all-time high, Lester. So it's definitely, we're at a very kind of precarious moment, both in terms of the trade relationship and also don't forget about our investment relationship with the failure to arrive at a bilateral investment treaty toward the end of the Obama administration and the cessation of those efforts by the Trump administration.
So what's this China Week actually amount to?
Michigan China Week, which is a first-time effort, is really an opportunity for us at the state level to showcase some of Michigan's greatest assets for a group of folks, partners, that we've kind of been building relationships with over the years back in China.
How many people are you talking about?
We had more than 150 folks come over from China for this. And of the 150, probably 2/3 of those were companies and mostly senior folks, decision makers from companies. The remaining third would have been officials from the provincial or city level from various regions of China.
Tell me, how significant is this Michigan-Chinese trade connection?
Well, it's tremendously important for Michigan companies, to be sure. We export, obviously, billions of dollars in goods and services to other countries. China is our number 3 recipient of those goods and services. So behind Canada and Mexico,
You know, China is an enormous export market for a lot of Michigan companies. And the other, the flip side of that coin is that Chinese companies, you know, much like German companies, Japanese companies, Korean companies before them, are coming to Michigan to create jobs here in terms of setting up factories or R&D centers, warehouses, and what have you. There are more than 6,500 Michigan jobs that are supported by these kinds of investments by Chinese companies.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder has made trips to China. He's been pushing for greater trade ties with China. Now we have this visit to Michigan by these Chinese representatives. How can Chinese provinces and states like Michigan talk about trade agreements when there's so much uncertainty at the national level?
Well, we certainly do play a different role. I think you're right about that. You know, to some extent, we are just kind of waiting for to see how the environment will shape up. But at the same time, you know, the trade team of Trump's administration, they're not the ones that are out there doing the deals, and they're not the ones who have investments and plants in China. So the folks that we're talking to here at the state level are, in a practical sense, in some ways more involved with these issues on a day-to-day basis than some of those folks are. And it's a good reminder that those relationships are really rooted in these kinds of partnerships that happen between states, between regions of China, companies in China, and then ultimately also people to people between Chinese folks living in the regions over there and local people over here in Michigan. So we think we have something to bring to the conversation, too, in terms of what these cooperation efforts look like on the ground level.
I realize that a lot of these pitches back and forth are between business members, but in general, what is Michigan's elevator pitch to the Chinese delegation?
Well, it's easy to tell our story, given, you know, that Michigan has performed so well, I think, in recent years, going from an auto industry that some might characterize as having been a little bit complacent and resting on its laurels some decades ago. We now have a resurgent industry, huge amounts of expenditures and R&D, a terrific set of talent in Michigan. We have one of the greatest concentrations of technical talent and engineering talent anywhere in the world. And so for Chinese companies that are looking to do business in something like advanced manufacturing or Internet of Things, certainly everything automotive, we just have a very easy story to tell in some ways. And you can see it in the numbers. Michigan has dominated in terms of attracting investments in the automotive field from China. There's no other region that has the kind of presence from some of the big Chinese automakers or some of the big Chinese auto suppliers that we do here in Michigan.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the auto industry because China is saying, you know, we are going to start building a lot of automobiles and they're going to concentrate on electric vehicles, as I understand it. How does that affect this state with such a heavy reliance on automobiles?
It is true that, you know, China has become a world leader in electric vehicles. They now are the biggest producer of electric vehicles. They have the world's largest market for electric vehicles. You know, to keep it in perspective, China sells somewhere north of 23 million units per year, where in North America we're more around 17 million units, something in that ballpark. And in China, maybe 1 million of those are electric vehicles. So the government is pushing this really hard over there. They have lots of subsidies in place at the federal level, oftentimes at the provincial or city level, to encourage the purchase and production of electric vehicles. And so that it's kind of a risk. You know, they're making a major bet on electric vehicles in China. They're trying to create the entire regulatory infrastructure, all the charging stations and everything to make that a reality. So even though it's, that market is being propped up heavily by the government and could not survive without those subsidies at this time, they're still producing these new technologies. And that does give them an edge in terms of those new technological breakthroughs and trying to bring some of these technologies to scale so that the price can come down.
As this Chinese delegation visited Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Grand Rapids, how well informed did they seem to be about Michigan business?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think people in China do have a lot of misperceptions about Michigan. You know, certainly the media environment over there is not as open as it could be, and that can lead, I think, to some pretty inaccurate information from time to time. And so they still have a perception that Detroit represents the Rust Belt, you know, represents industrial decline, and they come over here and we take them on a walking tour, you know, led by Quicken Loans, who has really, you know, transformed the downtown landscape with its investments and taken to some of our innovative infrastructure that we have here in terms of development and testing of driverless vehicles. And they're just blown away. You know, I think a lot of them walk out of here with a very different impression of our state frankly, a lot more interest in doing business here, you know, either by investing here or doing some kind of joint venture to try to buy some more Michigan products. And we even had one gentleman say, hey, you know, I was going to send my kid to Boston University. I'm now looking at U of M and Ann Arbor after our visit there. So those are the kinds of, you know, impressions that we hope to leave on our visitors after they participate in something like Michigan China Week.
I'm really interested if either side said anything about President Xi's tougher China first or Trump's America first stances. Did they talk candidly about that?
I think, you know, the Chinese side, especially the officials, are cautious. Certainly, they have their own personal opinions on these matters, I think, as a lot of Americans do too. But it's really a stark difference between the two systems in terms of the way that we approach freedom of expression.
So I'm taking it you're saying there wasn't a candid conversation about this.
Well, you know, if your boss is Xi Jinping and you don't like something he's doing and you're Chinese, there's a limit to how candid you can be.
Right. Brian Connors is the executive director of the Michigan China Innovation Center. We've been talking about this week's visit by government and business delegations from six of Michigan's partner provinces in China. Hey, thanks for the update.
Yeah, thank you, Lester.
Starting tomorrow, a new art exhibition is taking place at the David Klein Gallery in Detroit. The title of it is Old. The artist is Scott Hocking, and he joins me now. Hi there.
Hi there.
So we're going to have some photos online to so people can actually see some of your work, but would you describe your work for us?
Sure. I consider myself a site-specific installation artist, a sculptor, a photographer. I kind of do everything but paint, and ironically, in this exhibition, I'll also be painting.
Well, give me some of the examples of one of your installations in Detroit. What does one of them look like?
Some of the projects I've done in Detroit involve me using vacant buildings, vacant spaces, wasted materials, creating sculptures and installations on site with the material I find. And that's a process I've carried into other projects outside of Detroit. So there'll be a number of projects in this exhibition that were done in that same vein, but in other places.
So what are you trying to say with these installations?
Well, the exhibition title, Old, for me, was a word that it kind of took on a lot of different levels of meaning. Personally, I'm feeling old. I've been doing this in Detroit for over 20 years now, making art. I do projects that are very physically stressful. I end up injuring myself a lot. I work myself to the point where I'm in a lot of pain, and that seems to be happening a lot more as I'm getting older. One of the projects is a project where I took down an 1890s barn and then reconstructed it as a sculpture, which was a very Sisyphean task. And I do have this process that is very much like a Sisyphean task over and over again, creating these large-scale works that end up being destroyed.
Some of your installations, as I looked at the photos available to me, are mounds, for example, mounds of discarded toxic gloves, a pyramid of bricks, a large egg-shaped mound of marble pieces. What do mounds represent to you?
Yeah, it's a funny thing because I think before I started working like that, I wasn't necessarily taken with the word mound. But a lot of my interests connect to the ancient past. So when I create a pyramid-type structure or an egg shape or even just a mound, to me that connects to ancient earthworks, ancient structures, trying to kind of reflect on the past and how we perceive the past now. And most importantly, how we'll be perceived in the future. And one of the most evident contrasts I often use is if I'm creating a sculpture that has these kind of archetypal imagery or images, shapes inside vacant structures, for example, things that people might refer to as ruins, then I'm interested in how people perceive a ruin within a ruin, why one ruin might be considered a monument while another might be considered something negative, and kind of playing with how we perceive ourselves now versus the past and how we'll be perceived in the future.
I assume there are only a few people who actually see these installations in these abandoned and decaying buildings in Detroit. How do you relay your sculptures to a larger population? Is it through photos, videos? How do you do that?
Yeah, so for me, one of the most interesting parts of working like this is that it's very ephemeral. They don't last forever. They get destroyed either by man or nature pretty quickly. So I capture the process through photography, and they end up becoming a series of photographs as well as a site-specific installation. And the people who see the site-specific works are very rarely people connected to the art world. So there's a very different audience, and I really like playing with that. The people who see the photos in an exhibition, like the photos that will be exhibited in this exhibition, in a lot of cases, they're never going to see the actual work. So there's a dual process to it. I really like playing around with the difference between the people who perceive it on site and how they react versus the people who see it in a gallery space, a white-walled space.
How do you choose a site?
Wow. So a site, for me, has to have a lot of factors. It has to be something that I feel in my gut is something interesting. It has to have material I can work with. I really prefer to work with material on site and not use anything that I bring in. I'd like to use and reuse wasted material.
Let me stop you there for a second, because there was one of the things that really puzzled me. There's this one, it looks like a pyramid. You called it Ziggurat.
The Ziggurat piece was done in Fisher Body 21, which is about a two-minute walk from where I've lived for 17 years now.
So that's a lot of bricks, and I was wondering, was that on site or not?
Yeah, so those that's a great example, because those old factories that were made out of cast concrete, a very kind of Albert Kahn typical designed factory, would often have pine end block flooring. Is very, very common. You'd find it in the Packard plant and most any other factory of that age. So over the many, many years of it being abandoned and the elements taking it apart, decaying it, all of these wooden blocks started to pop up in these very interesting organic vein-like patterns. And I always loved how it looked, the way nature had created this design. And after many years of using material in that building, I decided to work on site and use all those bricks. There's, I believe, 6,201 wooden blocks used for that structure.
How does your work in Detroit reflect what's happening in the city?
Well, I've been here my whole life, and my opinion as a kid was based on what I was hearing from my parents, from my grandparents, and a lot of people around me. I grew up in Redford Township, and then for high school, I moved to Livonia. And there was a lot of suburban perspectives that were very negative, and I think I really rebelled against that. I started to see a lot of the things happening in the city as part of a very, very human cycle that we go through in cities and civilizations worldwide forever. We kind of do this pattern over and over again of consuming and creating a space and essentially at some point moving on to the next one and letting it wither away until it becomes reinvented into something else. So for me, I was first drawn to working in the quote-unquote abandoned sites, partly because I saw beauty in that cycle. I saw beauty in the decay. So when things are changing, I adapt to it. The Packard plant is a great example because it was a place that was the iconic abandoned building in Detroit that people would come and traipse through for many years. And now they are essentially giving tours. I think you have to pay to have tours to go through this ruin. And it will be theoretically renovated at some point. Like I said earlier, I'm excited by all aspects. So my process will change, but my process has always been basically me working with the environment I have. And as that environment has changed, my process changes.
I want to ask you one more question. You're familiar with the term ruin porn. There's been a lot of criticism of photographers who come in out from out of town, go into some of these abandoned buildings or homes and shoot it, then post it. And, you know, some of them make some money off of it, too. How is your work different from that, or is it?
Well, people can decide what they want about my work. One of the things that's great about being an artist is that you have your own vision, your own ideas, and you have to stick with them no matter if people praise you or if people criticize you. And there's always going to be people doing both, and you can't really let either of that get to you if you really believe in what you're doing. I personally believe that the main difference between the term ruin porn and other artworks, maybe things like what I do, is that the two words dissected, the idea of ruin in this context is a negative idea of ruin. And like I said earlier, it's interesting how we can go to Rome and talk about the ruins of Rome, but not talk about it in a negative sense. And to me, that's connected to time, the time it takes between looking at something that you're nostalgic for and connected to and something that's hundreds of years ago. Then the word ruin takes on a different meaning. And the second word, pornography, I really feel like somebody explained it to me once, and I thought it was a really great explanation to say, basically, we're talking about a relationship with a place. Someone who's come in and basically had a one-night stand with a place and left and then made a book out of it that might be ruin porn. But someone who's been here their whole life, and I'm basically married to the city, and I've spent I don't know how many years going into these buildings, to me there's a difference between what might be considered spectator-type tourism to just come in, parachute in, and photograph ruins all over the world, and it's very popular for people to do that all over the world now, and someone who actually invests time in a place, in the history, learns about the history, wants to talk about the history, and for me, that's very important.
Scott Hocking is a Detroit-based artist. His exhibit, Old, is being shown at the David Klein Gallery starting tomorrow and through June 23rd. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, we'll talk to the CEO of Cooperative Capital. That's a startup that wants to help small investors come together to invest in their own communities. That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, a Michigan State University trustee called for a new day, a change of culture that apologizes, admits failure, offers justice instead of the institution positioning itself defensively. That statement comes during the continuing fallout connected with the scandal of former MSU Dr. Larry Nassar sexually assaulting many girls and young women and insisting it was a medical treatment. The author of that statement, calling for change, is MSU trustee Brian Masalam, and he joins us now. What do you mean by new day, MSU?
You know, I think the posture, taking a position publicly of we're sorry, holding ourselves accountable, learning from our courageous survivors, and really implementing reform that involves accountability, board oversight, compliance, independent oversight, health and wellness reform. I think we need to change our posture of being so defensive and really begin to implement real reform. And this is a plan that I've been working on for 3 months after my town hall, I believe it was February 1st, and listening to hundreds of voices across the campus and campus stakeholders, and something that I've really, from a policy point perspective, thought about and crafted over the last 90 days.
We've heard members of the Board of Trustees apologize to the survivors of Nassar's abuse before, and then the university turned around and began vigorously defending itself from those very same survivors' lawsuits. How does this statement change things?
This is about policy and reform. This is about being held accountable. This is about moving this university forward, which involves a creation of a sexual misconduct survivors advisory committee going forward and an ongoing dialogue. You know, they have to be part of this reform. This university can't move past what has transpired without their input and their belief that we've implemented true reform.
Why has it taken so long to even get a proposal like this out by any of the Board of Trustees?
You know, good question. It's just one of those things where it transpired from my town hall. You know, I think the posture initially is lawsuits were filed, and we, you know, from the legal, we were looking at things from a legal perspective. And I think as an institution, you have an obligation to look at things beyond the legal perspective. We have to look at things ethically and morally. And it just, you know, this is something that I've been working on and crafting. And I thought after phase two of the Hush Blackwell report, it was time to release.
Since your statement was released, David Jesse at the Free Press reported that people at the university knew about inappropriate sex comments to and about students by Dean William Strample, Nassar's direct supervisor. But apparently nothing was done about it beyond sitting down with the guy and asking him to stop. This happened more than once. A legal counsel who was present at the meetings with the dean has submitted her resignation. You said she should leave, but she wasn't the only one still at the university who knew about this. So who else do you want to see go?
You know, really, I'm here to talk about my proposal on changing the culture of lack of accountability. You know,
well, this is about changing the culture. If you've still got people who thought it was okay just to ask the guys to stop.
Well, that, I mean, if you see part of my review is an immediate to begin an immediate independent internal review of the Nassar matter. Nobody has told this board of trustees how this happened and who was responsible for it. So, you know, before we rush to judge anybody else, since January, I have been calling for an independent external review of the Nassar matter that would be made public. They have fallen on deaf ears. This is something I think we need for the sake of transparency to move forward as a university, that this needs to be done. And this needs to be published to the public. So, you know, I don't want to jump ahead of myself, but, I've been very critical of the Office of the General Counsel since January. But ultimately, this is what's going to need to be done so the public views Michigan State University as transparent.
You already have an external investigation going on through the Attorney General's office. Do you not have confidence in that coming up with the material that the board needs to make decisions?
Well, remember, the scope of that is more criminal. So the AG's focus is on criminality. I'm talking about accountability. I'm talking about what transpired, where were the failures that this slipped through the cracks, and ultimately who's those are the things that I'm looking for. The scope's a little bit different. I mean, we as a board have an independent fiduciary oversight of this university, and you know, we need a report like this to understand how this happened.
I want to talk about the board of trustees in general for a second. It's fair to say that some people have lost confidence in the board of trustees. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
So do you think this board should be the one choosing a new president to guide the university?
Hey, all I can do is speak for myself. I think I've been outspoken on this issue. I think I've talked about the things that I would like to see happen. I formalized a plan of reform that I think we can adopt to move this university forward. And this is really my focus right now. I think before we even talk about a new president and bring in a new president, there are things that we have to resolve. We have to begin the reform, put in these quality controls, convince the MSU community and the stakeholders that we're moving forward. There will be a new day at Michigan State, and have ongoing dialogue with our courageous survivors to implement those plans. So before we can talk about all that other stuff, this needs to be put in place first.
Well, as you know, there have been a number of calls for the resignation of the Board of Trustees. If you want to change culture at Michigan State University, change generally starts at the top. Do you think that change might start if you and the other members of the Board of Trustees considered resigning?
I think ultimately implementation of this plan and reform is going to change culture. I think when you hold people accountable, I think when the information begins to flow both ways, I think when you put in compliance functions, I think when you put in, you know, we begin to really oversight, enforce our independent oversight culture. I think changing boards and terminating people and doing things, you know, those can only go so far in terms of accountability, in terms of the way operations flow. So I think first we need to start with this plan and really begin the new day at Michigan State. And really, if you want to change culture, this is the real reform that needs to be done right now.
If you wanted to see reform in the Board of Trustees, where would you start?
Well, we need to increase our oversight of this university without question. Number one, we need to create our audit and risk committee where we need to implement a chief compliance officer that's a direct report to this board. We need to implement an outside compliance firm to make sure they're breaking down silos and we're improving culture that's reporting to the board. We need all Title IX investigations, all sexual assault claims to come to this board so we can see them. These are some of the reform that we need. We need to move our Thursday meetings to comply with the Open Meetings Act to hold trustees more accountable. So we need to increase, this is how board oversight increases. This is how we begin to enhance our oversight over this. These are some of the things that we need to do. Because when you looked at this incident of, you know, the 2014 report, what, you know, why didn't the trustees know about Larry Nassar? How could we have found out? The 14, the Thomas Shaw report, never went to the Board of Trustees. So how do we stop that from happening? How does that get to us so we're alerted if there are troubled situations? And I think I've put together a pretty good plan to help us get there.
Ryan Massalem is a member of the Board of Trustees of Michigan State University. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Many of the vacant homes in Detroit are owned by out-of-state investors who bought them at tax auction. They sometimes sit empty until they're stripped by scrappers or burned down by arsonists. A new startup is suggesting that neighbors buy vacant houses, and it will help them do that. The project is called Cooperative Capital. The CEO is Kwaku Ose, and he joins us now. So that description was a little oversimplified. Let's look exactly what you're doing. You're putting together a fund in which neighbors can put in some money, see a neighborhood house fixed up and sold, and get a return on their investment. What's the minimum they can invest?
Any Michigan resident can participate in our Detroit Cooperative Capital Fund, which is called Detroit Community Capital, and any Michigan resident would be able to join for a minimum of $1,000.
Are you encouraging Detroit neighborhoods, neighbors to do it first? You said it's open to all of Michigan, but if the goal is to make sure that Detroit neighbors get a chance to actually, you know, invest in their own community, that would be preferred?
Yes, yes. So our marketing is focused on Detroit residents, Detroit, Highland Park, and Hamtramck residents specifically, and really people in the southeast Michigan ring, but technically any Michigan resident can invest in the fund.
A recent study found that most families can't come up with much more than $400 to deal with a household emergency. Detroit has a higher rate of poverty than most cities. How difficult is it going to be to find Detroit residents who can afford to invest $1,000?
Yeah, so what we have so far is a little over 100 Detroit residents that have already committed to join this fund, and we're finding that it's a wide array, a diverse group. So while this may be something that's not accessible to everyone at the moment, they're definitely, you know, in a city of over 600,000 people, we believe that there is a good nucleus of people that could participate now, and even with that, we are coming up with really, we don't want that $1,000 to be such a barrier, and we realize that for some people, $1,000 is not much, but for many more, $1,000 is too much. So we're coming up with additional avenues in which we could help people that don't have that money laying around at the moment to be able to participate. And one thing that we're in talks with two foundations, so it's nothing definite just yet, but we're working on what's called an individual development account. And the idea here is that, you know, a resident from a low moderate income background would be able to, if they participated in a financial literacy program and saved $500 over 6 months, a foundation will come and do a matching grant to allow them to invest in Cooperative Capital.
And that's a possibility that might be happening.
That's right.
So tell me what you guys are going to do with this money.
It might make sense for me to just briefly explain the model, because that might shed light on it. And so a Michigan resident can join for a minimum of $1,000. Each $1,000 gets them a vote. We cap members off at 10 votes no matter how much they invest so that no one member can sway the whole group. We have an investment committee made up of members that actually have backgrounds in the spaces we'll be investing in. Their role is to review all opportunities that come in, so you can almost think of them as a screener. So they will review these opportunities independently on their own, rate them on a scale of 1 to 10. We'll then take the top 5 highest rated opportunities to share with the full group of investors on a monthly basis. And once it's shared with the group, we'll give members 7 days to vote yes or no on each opportunity. Majority wins. Majority in our case is 51%. So if it passes that stage, then we'll do due diligence. And our due diligence is just to ensure that there's a realistic pathway or a pathway for that respective opportunity to produce at least a 6% annual rate of growth on the capital we're going to invest.
6%? That's not bad.
Yeah, it's not too shabby, especially compared to what most people are getting when you compare it to typical savings account or even a 5-year CD, but it's definitely not in the range of what you would typically be looking to get if you're going to, you know, put your money with a typical VC fund or a private equity fund, which oftentimes are looking for, you know, returns beyond, you know,
right,
15, even as high as 20% plus, and oftentimes even a multiple of that.
So what's the risk to investors?
With any investment of any kind, especially the type that we're talking about, there is no guarantee. So while that's our aim, there's no guarantee that would actually even have a return on an investment, period. That being said, when you look at, specifically in Detroit, when you look at the real estate market, the three things we're looking at doing, by the way, I should just briefly explain that, is one, you know, we're looking to be a small equity partner in much larger projects being led by larger developers and community development corporations. And in many of the projects, we have many of the larger developers in Detroit and many of the community development organizations already in our pipeline as far as allowing us to participate in their larger projects. Many of the projects we've looked at, you know, have 8% plus annual rate of returns attached to those projects. And, you know, some of them are as high as 12% on an annual basis. And then we're looking to basically use our pooled funds to acquire properties, rehab them, put them up front for sale. And in that department, you know, there are many. I'll just give you one example of something I recently did personally. I bought a property in Detroit for $6,500, threw an additional $31,000 into rehab, so about, call it $38,000 all in. I now rent out that property for $1,000 a month. From a gross revenue perspective, that's $12,000 coming back to me on an annual basis. This is an area where a lot of development is happening, so we could expect increased rents and an appreciation of that property over the years as, you know, time and development continues to increase. And right there, at a gross, you know, cash-on-cash return value, you're looking at something that's upwards of 30%. And a lot of those opportunities exist in Detroit. The issue is that not many people have the, you know, the $30,000 to $50,000 that it's going to take to actually be able to do rehab on their own. And so while people maybe don't have that money on their own, with our model, by pooling our funds together, they can now get that same, they can now participate in what they couldn't be able to do on their own in this collective model.
So what's your motivation for cooperative capital? What's your goal here?
The true goal is creating a situation where residents are able to come together to collectively invest and build up the community in a way that everyone benefits. I'm originally from Alexandria, Virginia. I first saw Detroit the summer of 2011 and moved to Detroit summer 2013. I used to work with Dan Gilbert at Rock Ventures and Special Projects. And between 2011 and 2013, I mean, the place was it was already on a rebound that was very visible. You know, I think people could see that Detroit is making a strong comeback. There's a lot of people that want to participate in Detroit's revival, but unfortunately, a lot of people feel that if they're not a billionaire, millionaire, celebrity, or politician, there's no way for them to invest in Detroit's recovery. And though that's not exactly true, and you and I know that, the thought alone is enough of a limitation for many people. And that creates, you know, two kind of issues. On one hand, you have a considerable amount of money that's just sitting on sidelines that could otherwise be going towards Detroit's recovery. But second, there's almost this ill will festering because people are seeing their community vastly change before their eyes. They feel they have no voice, no choice on how things are developing. And meanwhile, they're seeing the same wealthy people taking advantage of, you know, what appears to be like almost a once-in-a-lifetime economic event that they wish they could also participate in but feel they can't. So that's, you know, it's creating this atmosphere and environment that isn't healthy and isn't necessary. And to not repeat previous things that have happened in the city in the past, what we see with cooperative capital is a vehicle to solve for those two kind of challenges that are happening. And in the meanwhile, creating a situation where residents are now able to come together. And we think that there is a lot of benefit from this kind of alignment, not only from a social cohesion standpoint, from an economic mobility standpoint, from a local Detroit economy resiliency standpoint. And we think that all tides can rise with the model that we're building here.
Right. You're talking about making the Detroit economy more equitable.
That's right.
That's Kwaku Ose. He's the CEO of Detroit Community Capital, part of Cooperative Capital Nationwide, a startup which intends to help small investors come together to invest in their communities. Thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you, Lester. I really appreciate it.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who was our sloppy, unsolicited armchair psychologist today. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Rusty.